Hi everyone, you're going to absolutely love this episode of Tim Topham TV. This is podcast episode number 40. Hi everyone, and thanks so much for watching again this episode of Tim Topham TV, the piano teaching podcast, when we'll be discussing ways to scale your summer camp program with two people who know how to do it best. I'm going to introduce them in just a moment, but before we get to that, I did want to thank my sponsor today, which is Make More, Teach Less, which is the online summer camp training program for teachers by the fantastic Jennifer Fox, who was on a couple of episodes ago, so make sure you check out that interview, and she explains much more in detail about what she's up to. But look, she's been blogging for a long time and this is her first kind of online training package and she has just blown it away. If you are interested in starting a summer camp or expanding your summer camp, anything to do with summer camps, in fact, anything to do with group teaching, games, fun stuff at the piano, this is the course to check out. She has put together a training module of about 9 videos and a whole lot of bonuses. You can read all about it, find out more, and get a link for a discount if you head over to timtopham.com/summer-camp. That's summer-camp. Okay, I'm so excited to tell you about today's episode. This was one of the most fun recordings that I've done recently because the two people that I'm interviewing, firstly, Jennifer Auerbach and Josh Hawkes, both from an organization called Bocal Majority, were just so happy to give away so much information give me a good laugh in the process. We just had a great time. I think you really enjoy the interview. So today's topic is all about scaling. We've talked a fair bit in the last couple of episodes about building a summer camp from the beginning, the sort of activities you can do, themes, where to find resources. So today's episode is going to be fantastic for your future dreams and visions about what your summer camp could look like down the track. And this is going to be great for people who are already operating a summer camp and would like to perhaps go to multiple destinations or multiple location programs or to hire more teachers in, that sort of thing. Let me tell you about our guest today. Jennifer Auerbach is the CEO and founder of the organization called Bocal Majority. She holds a bachelor's degree in bassoon performance from Chicago Musical College and a master's and doctoral degrees in music theory from the University of North Texas. She's taught private bassoon lessons in the Dallas area since 1998 and has given numerous clinics at the Texas Music Educators Convention, the International Double Reed Society, and many other conventions. Now, before you all stop listening because this is you think you're on the wrong podcast and it's about bassoons, these guys, everything we're talking about is completely relevant to anyone teaching music and running summer camps. So it doesn't matter what instrument you're running it on, you're going to find this interesting, trust me. My second guest is Josh Hawkes. He's the vice president of Bocal Majority, and he's been with that organization since 2009. So he's a double reed specialist. He teaches oboe, and he is a site manager for Bocal Majority. So he actually runs programs at some of these sites, which we'll hear about in a moment. And he's the director of educational outreach for the organization. He has degrees in both music and business, therefore, you know, is fantastically skilled to talk to us today about what to do when you're going to go big. Now, I read about Jennifer's organization, Bocal Majority, when I was reading The Savvy Music Teacher by David Cutler. It's on my resources list. If you haven't checked out the resources list, please do. Just head to my blog, timtopham.com, and right at the top, you'll see a link to resources. And in that, I list my favorite top 5 or 10 books for business and for teaching. And David Cutler's book, The Savvy Music Teacher, is right up there. And you can just click straight through and grab a copy. It is one of the best reads you will have at the moment when it comes to running the business side of your studio. He mentioned in here as a case study, Jennifer's organization. So I had to search it out because just wait till you hear how many sites these guys are running, the kind of programs they run, and how they confirm and how they ensure they have enough students on their programs to make them financially viable. There's a really cool trick. You're going to learn about it in this podcast. Let's take it away with Jennifer and Josh. So I'm very, very excited to welcome you guys to the show today. We've got with us here Jennifer Auerbach and Josh Hawkes. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming along.
Thanks for having us.
Definitely. Thank you.
Now, you guys are a little bit special on the podcast because you're the first teachers I've been interviewing who aren't actually piano teachers. So you better give us a little bit of background as to your musical background and the teaching that you do today. Maybe start with Jennifer.
Okay. Well, Tim, I'm a bassoon player, and of course that's a double reed, an orchestral and band instrument here in Texas. And I teach private lessons. I actually started out on the clarinet, and our band program when I was in high school needed somebody to play the bassoon, and so I taught myself. And so that was a really neat introduction to it, and it took off. I loved it so much, and I studied it in college, and now here I am.
Isn't that funny? I wouldn't have thought teaching yourself bassoon would be something I'd hear from many people.
Well, I did it wrong.
Yeah, right.
The cool thing is that I did it wrong for quite a while, you know, for a couple of months, and I was lucky enough to go to a double reed camp. I actually went to a camp where there were bassoon teachers, and I learned everything I could because there were really no teachers where I was, and it was so influential, and you can see that that was definitely one of the reasons that we started this camp.
Got it. What about you, Josh?
Oh, my name is Josh Hawks. I am also a private teacher in the Dallas area. I currently have a studio of about 25 oboe students. Like Jennifer, I started on saxophone, and when I was in middle school, I switched to oboe. And again, I was self-taught. I didn't have a teacher. And then when I moved to Texas as a high school student, the high school that I attended already had a lot of oboe players, so I actually switched again to bassoon and was self-taught on bassoon. So we were sort of definitely have that sort of feral double reed student experience together. So I think that's why we both believe in camp so much, because I was also without private instruction until college. So we definitely have that angle of being like the kid in the wild without any quality information. So I think that's really at the heart of what we do.
Yeah. No, that's great. Now everyone's going to be wondering, why on earth have I got some bassoon players on a piano teaching podcast? So you better tell us about your the summer camps that you run, because this is summer camp month on the blog, and the whole point of our conversation today is about actually scaling your summer camp, because you have just taken what was a small summer camp, and I've now heard a little bit about the background of why you started one, and you've just gone boom, like it is massive. So I can't wait to hear about it. Tell us this. It's called Bocal Majority, which I'm interested about to know about the name for one. But tell me did I say that right? I don't even know.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So tell us about the name and what is it? What does it actually look like today?
Great. Well, you know, Bocal Majority is kind of an interesting name. There's actually a group around here that's called the Vocal Majority, and that's it's a choir group.
Right.
And of course, you can think about what it might be like to say, well, you know, our opinions are swayed by the vocal majority. And so the word vocal actually has to do with the bassoon. It's sort of the metal mouthpiece that comes out of the wood, and that's called a vocal.
Is it?
And so
there you go. Starting, had no idea.
It's actually the idea of one of the bassoon moms, someone who is involved in our organization for a very long time. She said, why don't you call it vocal majority? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And it just kind of stuck.
Double reed players think it's terribly clever, and everybody else just thinks that we're mildly illiterate. They get it, and that's what it's all about. It's that inside joke.
All right, so what is it? You better tell us. What is vocal majority?
Well, Vocal Majority, the camp, really started in Dallas in 2005. We had a bassoon-only camp, and then it expanded in 2009, I think was the first year we added oboe. So when oboe was added, I came on board. My college professor got in contact with me. She was a colleague of Jennifer's. They had sort of talked about it the year previous, and they added oboe to that camp in Dallas. And then from there, we expanded to other locations in Texas and then all over the U.S.
Amazing.
We started out as one, and now we have about 22 locations nationwide.
Wow. And Josh, your role, I think, is vice president. Is that what the title is?
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yes. I'm currently vice president of technically marketing, and I'm also in charge of our educational outreach program. which is free to schools. They can get in touch with me and I'll come out and do master classes for them. I help them with beginner setup. I help them with read selection, really anything that they want me to do. And it's completely funded by Vocal Majority, which is really awesome to be able to offer that free service.
So, and Jennifer, you're in charge of Vocal Majority. Is it a company or a non-for-profit? How does it actually work?
Yeah, that's a really good question that we get a lot. When we were starting things out, the structure of how it was, I was in my 20s and I just sort of wanted to get some of my friends together and, you know, teach some kids how to make reads. And it was very casual. Everybody just wrote checks to me and we really very much did not know what we were doing. It was really kind of flying by the seat of our pants. And, you know, there was really, at that point, it wasn't something that I had a vision of starting like 25 locations. It was just like, hey, let's get together. This sounds like fun. And so eventually I realized that we needed to structure it like a company. And so we became a company around the time that the oboes came in line, because I realized at that point that growth was something we were specifically trying to do, and that it was no longer time for people to write checks to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was about 4 years in. I think you said you started 2005, about 2009, you added the new stream and you formed the company.
Yeah, exactly. Officially. And, you know, bank account and incorporation and all of that stuff.
Yep.
And so it is a for-profit organization. And the nice thing, we've gone back and forth about how we wanted that to be. But I think that that was a good decision for us because it means that we've maintained a lot of control over things. What it also means from the benefit, of course, of the nonprofit is that you can write grants. And I also have been on the board of many arts organizations, and I've been a grant writer. And so that can be a very helpful thing for a camp. And mm-hmm. so especially as I talk to a lot of people who are either starting camps or running them, that's one of the main questions that you have to decide. But another thing that you can do is you can have your for-profit organization, and then you can start a different organization that is a nonprofit if you wanted to provide scholarships or other things like that. And that can be a standalone thing that just works in tandem with your for-profit.
Got it. So were you trained in business? How do you have all this knowledge about companies and whatnot?
I really wish I could go back in time and tell myself to take a business class, because I didn't. I did not know the first thing about running a business. And, you know, it's funny because actually Josh is the one who has some business background. I have a bachelor's degree in bassoon performance and a master's and a doctorate in music theory. So,
right. So not very helpful.
No, 0%. Yeah, it's so funny because most of my family are business people, but I've never taken a business class. But Josh's background is a little different, actually.
Yeah, yeah, my first degree is in finance, and I worked for Goldman Sachs for 2 years. And at the end of my stint as an analyst, you kind of decide if you want to stay with the company or what you're going to do. And I decided to go back and get a music education degree. So I deliberately chose to be poor.
Yeah.
No, it was definitely, it was always what I wanted to do, but really didn't have the sort of the guts to go there. But now this is such a great marriage. I do a lot of our accounting and help with like reporting and things like that. I think when I first started helping with the background, I was like, so where are the balance sheets? Do we have a profit and loss? And they're just kind of like so definitely had a little bit of an influence in like our accounting. Now we do have like a full-time bookkeeper who takes care of a lot of that for us too, which is excellent.
Definitely. And I've gotten a lot of education along the way, and that's been really helpful. I mean I may not know at the beginning, I may not have known all the things that there are to know, but you know, the way I think about myself is I'm smart and industrious, and Josh is very patient, so let's work out well.
And look, you obviously from the start never had a plan to have such a huge operation. So you wouldn't have started it up like with all those structures from the beginning. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. All right, so we've got to find out exactly what it looked like when it started. How many kids did you have on your first camp? Was it residential? Yeah. How many days, if you can remember back? I know it's a little while back. Just approximately, you know, what did it look like?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it was really interesting. Ultimately, all the way back, before it was vocal majority, the way that we like to tell the story, which is really true, is that it started in my living room.
Right.
And it was like maybe 10 kids coming into my living room and let's learn how to make reeds. But when it was really vocal majority, we held it at a middle school and there were 20 students. And I got my friends together. I hired them as teachers. And we all came and taught from about 9 to 5 for 5 days. It was not residential. It was a commuter style camp. And we really kind of made it up as we went along.
Yep. And it was a mixture of one-on-one lessons, master classes, the reed making, I assume games, you know, chilling out. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So reed making is definite, and we're going to talk about what an important part of what we do reed making is. So reed making was a big part of it back then. We had small ensembles.
Actually, to talk about that now, I didn't even know reed making was a thing. Like, I assume you just get them from a factory or something. This is the pianist talking now. So you better tell us why was that an important part of the camps?
Absolutely. Well, you know, actually, yeah, we were just talking about this actually.
Really, it's the biggest draw to the camps because as double reed players, really one of the most frustrating parts about playing our instruments is that you can't really access quality reeds, which is of course the thing that is amplified that makes your instrument sound beautiful or terrible.
Right.
The reed making is a huge draw to the students. They want to understand how they work, how they can improve them. And really the majority of our day is spent in reed making. So they really do, they learn a lot of the finishing processes. They take the reed from what we call a blank to a finished reed, and they learn a lot about it. They may not leave the camp with enough skills to be self-sufficient, but they learn enough about their reeds that they can understand if there's something going on, how do they fix it, and some things that they can do. So it really is the bane of most double reed players' existence.
Right.
I mean, we really commit a lot of time to making reeds as professional musicians.
With a pianist, you're not going to make your strings or your keys, but we make our mouthpiece every single time we play. We are always making our reeds. So it's even different than a clarinet or a saxophone. That's a very common thing for professionals to do.
There you go. I've learned so much today. I know what a bocal is, and I know that you guys make reeds. I really didn't know that. It's really interesting. And I was trying to think, as you're talking, whether there is actually a crossover into piano, but I couldn't think of one, obviously.
I don't think so. I mean, other than like maybe learning how to tune your own piano, maybe, but that's
another whole thing. That's right. So you started, I love the fact that you said you started in your house. You almost glossed over that, but you know, that's the way, the other people who I've talked about on these podcasts, you know, they say that's the best way to start. You know, you don't want to go out hiring, but great big venues or anything. So you started in your house, you invited your friends along, you just kind of made it up as you go. When was it that you worked out that you, so it was 4 years later that you expanded. How did you know it was time to expand? Because I imagine that then meant hiring staff, hiring venues. It becomes suddenly a bit more serious and risky.
Definitely. All of those things. You know, it was interesting. For the first couple of years, things expanded in different ways. So the first year, we had 20 students. They were 7th and 8th graders. So there was a limited age and a limited amount of them. And so then the next year, there were 25 or 30. And it got more and more. And then it came a time where a lot of people were telling me, hey, really, oboes have the same issues that you do on bassoon, and you should really consider adding oboes to the camp. And that's true. And so I didn't know anything about the oboe at all. And that's when I contacted our colleague that was Josh's college professor, because she was very knowledgeable about that, and we brought her on. And it was at that point where I knew that if I ever added oboes to what we were doing, that that was going to be a game changer and that I needed to look at things in a different way. And so immediately when that happened, we did a lot of change in a short period of time. Right. So we added several locations. I think we had 4 locations that year, and we added older students. So we had older students, a completely different instrument in multiple locations.
Oh my goodness. In 1 year, you went from one location with up to 60 kids or whatever it was to 4 locations with 2 instruments. That's huge. So how did you find the time to do that while you were teaching? Because you didn't have – did you have – you had Josh and some other people to help you then, like formally or not really?
Very informally. Yeah. That week – we had met that week of camp face-to-face. I slept on Jennifer's couch in, like, true Boca Majority fashion. I slept on her couch, and then I was processing cane all night. It was very much like just a bunch of pirates all getting together and throwing a party. We were definitely making it up as we were going along.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And I just really – I actually at that point in my life, I was still a doctoral student. And I had a lot of very interesting things going on all at once. So I was finishing my doctoral degree, and I was teaching college. I was teaching as an adjunct college professor.
Mm-hmm.
So I was teaching about – I think I was actually teaching 7 classes. And I was still teaching a couple of private lessons, and I was organizing the camps.
Sounds insane.
It was insane. I was writing my dissertation during all of that. So it was – I think that's just really – that's truly indicative of both Josh and me. We are both very driven people who work very hard, and we don't really take no for an answer, and we definitely expect a lot of ourselves and give a lot of ourselves. So as far as balancing things off, we're always looking for that balance. We're always readjusting because every time we make an adjustment – the camps are growing. The organization is growing because there are actually a lot of other components to our organization besides the camp, and we'll talk about that as well. But even now, we're actually I've had to pare down my studio over the years. I have about 35 right now, and I probably have, and those are private lesson students, so I'll probably have about half of that next year. Yep. As I adjust my schedule, and I think we're kind of about the same place.
Yeah. So it's still even now with how many locations have you got now?
22 locations.
22 locations. You're still not working full-time on that business. You're still teaching. You're still managing to teach.
Well, I think we both work several full-time jobs.
Yeah. I'm getting that feeling. All right, let's just go back a step. How did you market when you were first going to multiple locations? You went from 0 to 4 and 2 instruments. How did you market yourself to ensure that you would be getting the return that you needed?
Yeah, definitely. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think something that Jennifer and then our colleague Sally Bowles, who is a local teacher in Dallas, she's very established. Both of them have a really strong reputation of being established double reed pedagogues in our area. So they were doing a lot of clinics at our state level Music Education Association convention, which is about 32,000 people come to that in Texas every year. So they were doing this, and literally for like the past 13 years, they have done some kind of double reed clinic every year. So I think having them being such an established group of clinicians, when we were — and I say this a lot because I do a lot of these outreach programs now — because they have laid such a solid foundation for Boca Majority being kind of a household name in Texas, it's very easy for us to sort of expand and to be in touch with band directors, and they associate our brand with high quality double reed information. So it's been really — I think that was really like the kernel from which it was very easy to expand on.
Because they'll, you know, if we call somebody up and say, hey, we'd like to have a camp in your area, they already have a groundwork for who we are. Sometimes as we go out into other states, it's a little bit different because they may or may not know who we are. And so when you know, I'm often asked the question, well, how do we decide where else to go? So we're here in Texas, we have 11 locations. And so we have all these other locations in what might seem like random places, Virginia, North Carolina, Idaho, California. And so, you know, sometimes people say, well, is your goal to have a camp in every state? And that's not exactly how we think about it. Usually when we're talking about the locations that are outside of the state of Texas, most often it's that somebody approaches us and they've seen the success that we've had in other places. And so they say, well, hey, we'd like you to come in and do this. And we partner with those people. And so your question was, well, how do we ensure the success of those new locations? And there's a lot that has to go on to make a new location successful. So the most important thing is that there's somebody there at the heart of it, who's a teacher, a private lesson teacher, who wants us to be there and who believes in what we're doing.
Right.
From there, that person has to connect us with other private lesson teachers who are in the area, who also will in turn think highly about what we're doing and want to be involved in teaching at the camp. So they have to, so that original person has to not only be interested, but they also have to be connected to not only students, but other teachers. Furthermore, they have to be connected to band directors and other music educators who they
right.
can get students to recruit. Our minimum for a camp to make is 20. And so, and for, you can imagine with our locations in Texas, that's usually not an issue. Our largest camp that we've ever had, I think it was 110.
Wow.
Here, which is really a lot of bassoon and oboe players.
Yeah.
For kids. At our flagship location here in Dallas. Sometimes when we're talking about starting a new location, 20 is a lot. We work hard for every student that we recruit, especially in the first year. And we haven't always been successful. There have sometimes been places where the first year isn't so good. And sometimes even after we do it a couple of years, we still can't find the right formula. And it's by making those mistakes or going through those growing pains that we've learned what we do need to have. And so more often now than when we're starting a new location, we're better equipped to find the right formula for success.
Got it. And I assume you probably now have a format of the camp that works that you can then put into the different places. Would that be right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like a schedule?
Yeah, exactly. So how many days, what the students do, how they're mixed up, that sort of thing. So can you give us just a really quick summary of what you found tends to work for your particular instrument?
Yeah, absolutely. We, in the morning, we start with about a 15-minute staff meeting. So anybody's a teacher or involved in what we're doing is going to be at that meeting. Our staff look like this. We have one or two site managers, depending on the size of the location. We have the regular instructors. Sometimes we have instructors in our advanced division. Those are a special set of faculty. And then we also have camp interns, and these are college-age students who are receiving mentoring. So all of those people come to the meeting in the morning. And then there's a rehearsal for what will be later the faculty recital later in the day. So there's a brief rehearsal, about 30 minutes. Then programming starts usually around 10, and we'll have read-making time from about 10 to 12:30, and that seems like a lot of time, but we need it.
Right.
And it's the biggest draw to the camp. The kids love the read-making. They'll come back for more read-making later on.
Right.
We take a 30-minute lunch break, and then we come back for a small ensemble chamber music rehearsal. That piece that they're preparing in their small ensembles, it's about 3 to 7 students in a group, and they're going to be performing it on the final recital on the very last day. We'll have a little break. We'll have a technique time, and that's where the teachers can talk about whatever topic they feel is appropriate for the age group that they have. And then there's a large ensemble rehearsal, and we commission a piece every year, an arrangement, to be performed at the end of the final recital. This year, it is an arrangement of songs from The Wizard of Oz.
Right, all for bassoons and oboes.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. That would be interesting sound. Like, you would have to be a very clever arranger to
Maybe you really haven't lived until you've heard 125 people playing contrabassoon, bassoon, English horn, and oboe play. Like last year was The Nightmare Before Christmas. It was actually very appropriate for the kinds of sounds that were coming from the stage.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I could only imagine. I might have stopped you there, Jennifer. That was pretty much the end of the day. So finishing preparing this rehearsal for the end of the week. Is it a 5-day week? Is that how it works?
And the camps vary. They're either 4 days or 5 days long. And so it's just whatever the end of the week is, the fourth or fifth day.
Yep. Great. And so you've obviously got some volunteers. I assume your students kind of volunteer for the experience, but do you pay the staff, site managers and things? Are they all paid staff? How does that work? If you're happy to say.
Yeah, everybody is paid. Even the camp interns, which is a great sell. I mean, they actually, for a camp internship, they get paid pretty well. I mean, I was certainly not paid as well for my internship, which were free, slave labor.
Yeah, yeah. Normally is too. So that's a huge draw card for getting quality, I would imagine too.
Definitely.
Yeah. So one of the biggest issues when you're going to expand from a small thing that you can run yourself or just with a friend to a bigger program is hiring the right staff. So what tips have you got for hiring the right people for your programs?
Ooh. Well, the first thing you want to do is make a lot of mistakes early on so that you can learn from them.
And we did.
So what kind of hiring mistakes did you make?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, the funny thing about, you know, teaching is really a calling. And not everybody, you know, it comes really naturally to Josh and me. And so I guess it just doesn't occur to us that there are people out there who just don't love it as much as we do. But the truth is that there are. And there are some people who teach just because it's the thing that they can do.
Right.
And, you know, that's just the reality of the situation. And so just because somebody is a teacher doesn't mean that they are somebody who we would like to have involved in what we're doing. So maybe about 5 years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we sat down and we came up with a mission statement. And it goes to the heart of what we're actually really trying to do in everything that we do. And that is that we would like to provide high level information in a positive and uplifting environment. So everything has to fit into that category.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're coming to teach at our camp, you know, we don't care what shape of reed you're using. We don't care if you're using ands or tays to count eighth notes. That's not what's important to us, is that you're providing high-level information to the students and that you're doing it in a positive way. Mm. And so that's the heart of what we do. And when I interview everybody who's going to be involved with us. And so usually I'm interviewing people on the phone. And so my very first question that I find a way to ask very casually is, do you like teaching? And I just ask it. And I really listen to what people say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And usually people are pretty upfront with me. I think maybe at that point they're not
in interview mode.
Yeah.
They're very honest, usually very frank with their
opinion. That's what you want, isn't it? That's a great tip. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I really do. I listen to what they say. And if I get the sense that, I mean, you can usually tell when somebody, and if they need a little coaxing, I'll ask them what they like about teaching. But almost always when I've got somebody who I know is going to be a good fit, all I have to do is ask them, do you like teaching? And if they can talk for 5 minutes about why they like teaching, chances are it's going to be a pretty good fit.
Fantastic. What a great tip. I really like that. Yeah, it's so simple when it comes to the heart of everything that we do. Totally get it. Yeah. What about venues? Now, it sounds like when you move to a new or you establish a new program, you use the contact there, and that perhaps that person is the one who finds the space to use, do they?
Sometimes.
Okay.
It depends, because a lot of our locations outside of the state of Texas are colleges. And so, for example, the college professor might contact me and say, hey, we'd really like to have a camp here. I'm going to use our newest location, Moscow, Idaho. So the bassoon professor contacted me and said, we'd really like to have a camp here. And so, of course, the location is the university that they're attached to.
Right.
And so there are things that we need to do because we are the actual entity holding the event, but because we're partnering with those professors at the campus. Some of the paperwork has to be completed by us and some of it's by them, but we're always working together. So sometimes they reserve the actual rooms, but I might be in charge of contacting the housing and cafeteria to set all that up.
Got it.
And sign all the contracts, really.
Mm. And so if let's say one of my viewers is already running a summer camp and he's getting too many people and really needs another venue, do you again have any like tips about, I don't know, partnering with venues or the kinds of venues that work best?
Yeah, absolutely. Here in Texas, what we found is that middle schools are usually the easiest places to have the camps. That's because there's usually not summer school at a middle school.
Mm-hmm.
We can usually have a run of the place. There's not quite as much activity in the summer as there would be at a high school. Who we're actually partnering with when we do that is the band director. And so for us, we're serving the band programs by having this, and the band directors see this as a valuable thing for their students, and they want it at their school because they want their students to have access to it.
Mm.
And then we offer scholarships to their students, and so that's how we try to work it.
So that's how you get the support of the school along too, obviously. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And usually that will work. Now, sometimes that's not allowed by the school district. And when that's the case, we usually just go on and find another place. And we learned this early on. It's a pretty easy question to answer.
Yep. It's not something you then go and start negotiating or fighting. You're just like, nah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I understand. Oh, that's great. Some fantastic tips. I really appreciate you being so honest and just sharing all this stuff, because I know that there's a lot of talk. I was at MTNA, actually, which happened to be in San Antonio. Recently, and there was a lot of talk about moving to group teaching, doing more for piano teachers. This is doing more group teaching, working out summer camp plans, which is the whole point of this month on my blog. And so it's great to now hear someone who's, you know, just completely kicking goals, actually just sharing some of these ideas. So I really appreciate it.
Definitely. I want to follow up there, because, you know, we are associated with band programs, like the bassoon and oboe students who we serve are in band.
Mm.
But you're talking about, you know, piano students. So I would just encourage anybody, or violin or anything else, I would encourage the people who are listening to this to figure out who you're serving. Figure out which educators and who has a facility who you could say, hey, we're helping your students. And, you know, whether that's a church or a school or anything otherwise, maybe even a youth orchestra. So youth orchestras have facilities as well. And just sort of hit those people up and see what you can do to make it worth their while.
Yep, yep. That sounds great. I mean, you might as well work on some synergies with the people around you if you possibly can, particularly when they've got the keys to rooms with pianos in them, right? there's obviously a few different options for expansion for teachers who are already running programs. So would you say, you know, the best first thing to do is just increase your numbers on one site? Or perhaps just increase the amount of time? Or should you do, you know, back-to-back 2 different weeks during the same program? Or go multi-site? What's your kind of suggestion? Or Josh?
The answer to that would be yes. We've done that. When we first started, we had an Dallas camp, one Houston camp. And I think definitely what Jennifer came up with very early on was really a ratio that we wanted one teacher per 5 students. And the way that after the interview process is over and we vetted you and we want you to teach at our camp, the way that you are guaranteed your hire is that you are to bring 5 students. And once 5 students have been enrolled, then you are hired. So really that has been like the golden ratio. And that has really, that guarantees that the proper number of teachers per student. And there are teachers that we engage if we have more just random kids coming from programs that don't have lesson teachers, which that's really the purpose of the camp. We are able to engage those students or those teachers, but really having that ratio that gets that teacher motivated to recruit for you. In Dallas, now we do have 4 locations in Dallas.
Mm.
So we have expanded the number of camps, but it was really through that sort of those, I guess, lines of communication with the teachers and basing it on their recruitment.
Yep, that's a really, really clever decision. And I'm really glad that you hear that it's worked out for you. So that is, if you are looking to hire staff, the staff, once you've chosen them, you say, all right, you need to bring along 5 kids to this program. When you can confirm that, you're hired, sort of thing. I think it's great. It's a win-win for everyone.
For sure.
Yeah, very clever, very clever. All right. So look, I'm going to kind of start wrapping up with a few of my final questions. And I want to talk about some traps now. What do you think are some of the traps to avoid if you're going to start expanding your camp program?
Cool. Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that you see that we probably fell into is expanding so quickly. Mm. And so we definitely went that direction. But, you know, even as we did it, we would make these changes and we would expand really fast. I watched it happen kind of like in slow motion. And then I did it again. Like every year we've said, wow, we did a lot of expansion. Maybe we should slow down. And then we just did it anyways. So I guess I would say I think that you just got to do what you think is right as far as that goes. But I don't know, traps. Make sure that you think about legal things.
Ah, yeah. Please sure. Tell us more. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Insurance.
Yes. One of my jobs, and both, you know, and Josh and I, we have these titles, but really we have probably 20 jobs between the two of us in Boca Majority. But one of my jobs is, you know, is I'm in charge of compliance. And I, you know, it's something that we have to take very seriously because a lot of things could threaten our organization.
So what does that mean, being in charge of compliance? Complying with local regulations?
All kinds of things. Just the fact that we have insurance. Uh-huh. You know, I was talking, we actually often will mentor other camp directors who are either starting camps or running camps already. Mm. And one gentleman came to me recently, and they've been running their camp for about 5 years. They are not incorporated, they don't have a bank account, and they don't have insurance. And I was shocked.
Yeah.
And I said, stop whatever you're doing right this minute and incorporate and get a bank account and get insurance.
Yep.
Because you're setting yourself up to be liable for just about anything, all kinds of liability, both financially and just personally. I mean, you could be sued as a person.
Yeah.
And you know, we all hope that that's never going to happen. And, you know, certainly that's what we try to do. We try to have good policies to protect everybody, students and the people we work with, but things happen. And it's the reality of 2016. So just sort of thinking about those legal things instead of just thinking about having the camp and doing all the things you're doing.
Yep. And do you get public liability cover for each location and each camp for that week, or is it like a whole business thing that just covers you for whatever you do?
We are insured by a really, really wonderful insurer called Markel, and they do summer camps.
They are the largest
insurer of summer camps.
Right.
And I highly I don't like get any kind of kickback or anything from them, but I definitely recommend them. They've been excellent to work with. They've been very patient with us because we just didn't know. We didn't know what we didn't know.
Mm.
And there's a lot to know when it comes to that. So they yes, we have to name every specific place, and there's a lot of details we have to give, like how many students and all that stuff. But so, yes, every location is under that blanket. We hope to never exercise it.
Oh, that's right, but you've got it there if you need to. I also see that you do residential now. So you started with day programs only. So residential, that obviously adds elements of liability, I would assume, but, you know, more cost. You've got to feed people. They've got to sleep somewhere. How have you found that impact your summer camps? Has that been a positive thing?
I think so, definitely. I site manage. We were both site managers, actually, over the summer. So while we're managing the Leviathan, we are actually also participating. So I site manage one of our residential camps, and I also site manage a lot of the commuter camps as well. So it's cool to get that different perspective. At the residential camps, we don't do anything. There is no sort of programming that happens in the evening that is tied to double read stuff. Mm. So it's a great way to really get to know the students and to really the relationships that I have with those students are obviously way stronger than the commuter camps. I get to know them on a really profound level as people, and really we bond as humans. It's really cool to be able to have that experience with them. One of the another big draw or pull to our camp is that there are not a lot of instances where you are part of a large group. You may be the one bassoon player in your entire district, one oboist in your school. So it's a really cool time for them to sort of build a community. There isn't, you know, a pack of clarinet players, you know, that you can belong to, but it's really cool for them to really have that group identity. Because I think the people drawn to double reed instruments are very specific and their personality. so it's cool for them to find their tribe. And I think the residential camp is definitely a better place for that to happen.
Yeah, got it. So you must use venues then that they must be boarding schools or summer. No, well, what places have beds and everything for everyone?
I mean, we're doing it at colleges, so it's hosted at a college, and we're just in their dorm facilities.
Got it.
And some of them are really great to work with. Some of our programming gets to all happen in one dorm. They can do reed making there. We can do everything there. Some locations we have to hike around campus a little bit, but the housing is all in dorms over the summer.
And that's really great. It's set up really well for what we need, because usually the dorms are not as filled in the summer because the students are gone, or you know, there's at least more availability for that.
And do they do you use the catering of the college? So the college would like it because they're getting some extra income that would otherwise be not available, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fantastic. Wow. There is so much great stuff going on. I think we better just kind of talk about, wrap it up and just say, where can people find out more about you? Firstly, what's your website or websites and things?
Well, we actually do a lot of different things in support of our camps. But to find out more about Vocal Majority Summer Camps, go to www.vocalmajority.com. And from there, you can find out about some of the other year-round programming that we do as well.
All right. So tell us briefly. I know you've got – I've seen Operation Oboe. I've got no idea what that is. just makes me think of Homer Simpson going, Oboe Maboe. what are some of the other things that you're doing, you know, as well as these summer camp things?
We have master classes where we invite master teachers and players from all over the country. We host those mostly in Texas, but we'll have symphony players, major teachers from the country come in, and there's like the all-state sort of process that the Texas students go through. It's very cutthroat, so it's very a great way for them to get some help on their region music. We do that. We have a store that really supports our camp. I mean, the store is why I am hired as a Vocal Majority full-time employee. So we sell reeds and supplies and instruments all year round.
Is that online store or bricks and mortar?
Yes.
Yeah, online. Great.
Online.
Yep.
And we do. We also do trade shows. So we'll go to about anywhere between 12 and 15 trade shows year round all over the country. And that keeps us busy as well. And so that's – and we now have a separate website for our store. It used to all be on one website, and we outgrew that. And so now it's separate.
So what's the store site?
It's www.vocalmajoritystore.com.
There you go. Cool. Oh, well, people can go and check out all this stuff. I think you guys are doing amazing things. And I'm just so glad that you could give us your time today to share your wisdom and your mistakes and your traps and all that kind of stuff. It's been really, really good. Is there anything that you feel I might have missed out on, or that we should have covered today that I've forgotten?
No, great. This is great. You know, we're really excited about all of your viewers and all the cool things that they're going to do. And we just want to say thank you so much for letting us talk today.
Not at all. No, it's been an absolute pleasure. And, you know, if people have some questions, are you happy, you know, and they leave a question on the show notes page, you're happy if I just email you through, you can jump online and shoot an answer through. I don't know when you would have the time to do that, but
You'd be surprised.
I'm thinking, like me, you know, the busier you get, just the more you get done. It's you're that kind of that kind of people. That'll be a fantastic help. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. I know it's about 10 o'clock at night there, so I'll let you get some rest. and thanks again. We'll see you. Keep in touch.
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thank bye-bye. You. See ya.
If the idea of a piano teacher's community where you get to access the best educational resources, rub shoulders with expert teachers from around the world, and have immediate access to feedback for any of your questions, then Inner Circle membership is for you. The Inner Circle is my private community of piano teachers from across the globe who share a commitment to creating and delivering the most inspiring, modern, and progressive learning experiences for their students. Membership is now open, so head to timtopham.com/community to find out more and get involved today. I can't wait to see you on the inside.